Well, on the other hand, how many people drink NyQuil? Any NyQuil drink? There you are, right? NyQuil, 50 proof. It's kind of like you just throw the shot glass away and just chug it. And you can drink it right in front of people. You can sit at your desk, right, at work. Well, I got terrible sinus problems. And you can drink NyQuil. And that's helpful hints for the newcomer that's here. How many mouthwash drinkers in here? Yeah. People go, mouthwash? Oh, my God. Well, first of all, you can drink all you want and stand right in front of your boss and go, you got great breath. You're wobbling a little bit, but what the hell? You're looking good. And then you go, mouthwash. How could you drink mouthwash? Now, I want you to think back to your very first vodka, rum, gin, tequila, scotch. Very first one. And you took a shot of that. And you tell me you can't drink mouthwash. If that stuff even got down before it came back up through your nose, and you're standing there going, smooth, isn't that smooth? You know, and your throat is burning, and you're dying, and you're trying to figure out what's going on. Alcohol is an acquired taste, folks. We don't have to have an acquired taste for 7-Up. It doesn't do that to you. You know, Coke doesn't do that to you. But alcohol does that to you. So you have to acquire that taste to get going and really have some fun while you're out there drinking. My wife and I were out there. Some people have heard me say this. And she still drinks. My daughter drinks. I mean, well, they call it drinking. She'll go to a restaurant and order a martini. We were at a restaurant down in DeFilippi Steakhouse in Chula Vista, and we were sitting down there a couple of weeks ago, maybe about a month ago now, and we're sitting there, and she orders a martini, and then ungodly hour later, she orders another one. It took her a whole hour to drink that martini, and then she drank just half the other one, and then she says, I'm done. And I said, why? And she says, I'm feeling it. And I said, well, just push through that. You just have to push through that. We understand pushing through. How many people puked on somebody? See, I feel better because some of you don't look like alcoholics, and I just need to know who the alcoholics are in the room. How many peed in someplace, not a bathroom? See, even the women are holding their hands. For God's sakes, you got to love it. You just got to love this stuff. See, so they're the alcoholics. My wife has never peed in the closet. Never thrown up on anybody else. Never passed out with her face in the mashed potatoes. Anybody ever passed out in your own food? Yeah, see, there's more hands going up. If you were, you know, thinking that you were not an alcoholic, just look around here. You don't have to have, I don't have any DUIs. None. If that's the criteria, I am not an alcoholic. My sponsor, however, Jerry Bunn, informed me one day, not this, but we both know him, and he said, Steve, you don't have any DUIs? Knowing your drinking history, you've got at least 3,000 of them. You just didn't get arrested. So how many people have DUIs that did not get arrested? Okay, how many got arrested? Of course. So that's not the criteria. How much we drink, whether we drink beer or wine or scotch or vodka and soda. And, and you're going to date this woman? Mary, come talk to me afterwards, Ben. I mean, what a deal. You know, it's about how you feel. The big book says, I think it's in the doctor's opinion, we drink essentially to change how we feel. I'm lonely, I'm angry, I'm tired. I don't fit in, I don't belong, I'm not part of. I mean, I grew up in an alcoholic family, and like a lot of us did, some didn't. It was a violent family, alcoholic family, incestuous family. It was just a lot of stuff. Divorced when I was 5 years old. And I didn't drink alcohol until I was 18, and by today's standards, I'm old. But I didn't drink until I was 18. I went to college. My cousin picked me up at my uncle's house. I stayed with him before I got into a fraternity. And he said, we got to go drinking. And I said, why? He said, we're in college. And so we went down to some little beer joint in Manhattan, Kansas, where Kansas State University is located. And we started drinking pitchers of beer. I'd never drank. And champagne, the champagne of beer. Anybody ever heard of that one? Champagne. It was just piss water. It was just terrible stuff. But it was the lightest stuff that you could drink. And we sat there, and I started drinking that stuff, and he'd go to the bathroom, I'd throw it back in the pitcher, I'd put it under the table. But I drank enough that night that I literally just got drunker than a skunk, blacked out, passed out, and did doo-doo in my pants. It was nasty.
Amen.
I got up the next day and called him and said, let's go do that again. I really did. I thought, because something had happened that night. In high school, I had two dates the entire time I was in high school. I was so shy. I could not be around my peers. You terrified me. Nobody taught me to play sports. I was this terribly, terribly shy, skinny, small, geeky little guy. I mean, not like the stud that's up here tonight. I mean, it was just horrible. And then I got to college, and I found beer. And everything changed. Everything changed. Within weeks, I'm dating two or three times a week, going to parties. Within 6 months, I'm the fastest beer chugger on that campus, except the guy that taught me how to do it. And that was a badge of honor, because I could go into any bar in that college town. They say, see that kid coming through the door? Put $20 on the table, he'll give you a half glass start, and he'll beat you every time. I was a somebody. I had arrived. I was a chugger, and I could take anybody on anywhere, anytime. And most of college was just a blur. I escaped I had to beg for a D so I could get a C average to get out of college so I could get in the military. And I joined the military in college because I got drunk one night, and a friend of mine talked me into doing it. I had not planned on being in the military, but I knew I wasn't going on business like my aunt and my uncle, or my uncle and my father and my brother. And so I ended up in the Navy. And what they taught me into was being a Navy pilot. Now, I had never flown an airplane in my life. I had ridden in one twice. It had never crossed my mind to be a pilot. And I sign up, and there I am. And I'm in Pensacola, Florida, and for my very first flight. We come back in after flying for 45 minutes. We taxi back in. We shut down the airplane. And I'm sitting there shaking so hard, I can literally not stand up. My knees are shaking so bad. I am scared to death, terrified, capital print, underlined, bold print. I said, Steve, you've done some stupid things in your life, but this is the top of the stupid list. This is stupid. What the hell are you doing? And all you had to do was go in, and they wanted you reasonably excited if you were going to be a carrier pilot about chasing a carrier around the ocean. I was not reasonably excited. I was scared shitless. I didn't want to do this, but I'd stood up at this fraternity before I left. They had senior night and said, well, all the seniors graduating, where are you going? Well, I'm going to go work in a bank, and I'm going to be doing this, and I'm going into advertising. And what are you going to do, Steve? I'm going to be a Navy carrier pilot. To this day, I still remember, 70 guys. Yeah, right. Just laughing and putting me down one more time, and I held up this piece of paper and I said, signed, sealed, and delivered. Well, I can't go back and tell them I can't do this. I've got a character defect, which I still have today, which is at all costs look good, and if you can't look good, at least don't look bad. And going back to that fraternity and telling them I couldn't do it was not only looking good, it was looking bad. And so I'm one of those people when they say, hey, everybody, watch this. And the whole group turns around because they know it's going to be a major disaster. They go, well, there's an alcoholic who's just committed himself. He's jumping off the bridge and he's going because he said he was going. You've all done that. At some place, some party doing something, you said, watch me. And once you've made the commitment, you're not backing out of it. You'd rather die looking good than to admit you couldn't do that, that you'd made a bad decision. Anybody recognize that at all? A lot of us do. And so I flew airplanes for 18 years for the Navy. And to tell you that I was scared, terrified, I'd go out at night flying with my visor down, tears in my eyes. So you're going to die one of these days. But I didn't want to die in an airplane, and I got really good at flying because I didn't want to die in an airplane. Now, once I got through flight training, I was pretty able to hold my drinking together during flight training. But once I got out of there, it was Katie bar the door. And over the course of the next few years, I was flying with hangovers. Then I was flying drunk. When you quit drinking at 4 or 5 in the morning and you brief at 6 and you fly at 7, you're not hungover, you're drunk. But I'm going to tell you, folks, that I have never been injured flying or driving. Walking is tough for me when I'm drinking. I fall down a lot when I'm walking drunk. I've never, you know, ran off the road drinking. Never. Well, I did have a problem once in an airplane. We were in El Centro. A guy named Fritz Lynch, he's not an alcoholic. He's in town, and Fritz was, I was teaching him to fly an airplane. We were an airplane I was eventually going to fly in Vietnam. And so I was teaching Fritz to fly. Well, we'd been down over at El Centro. We'd gone to Mexicali all night. And we got back in about 7 in the morning, but they said the winds were really going to pick up in the afternoon, which our flights were, so they moved everything up in the morning. Well, any sane person would say, excuse me, I'm not only hungover, I'm just drunk. I can't fly. But I can fly. That's not a problem. So we get into this airplane, and we're doing touch-and-go landings, and a real big, heavy airplane. This one's fairly small turboprop. A big, heavy airplane came in, so they had us hold up out of the pattern, let this big plane in, let the wind settle down along the runway, and then we came in for our landings. And we'd been doing what we call touch-and-go landings, bang, up in the air, bang, up in the air, and we'd just leave your gear down. Well, we'd gone up, and so we picked our landing gear up because we were up in the altitude, and we came back down. We go through the checklist. We're coming out on final, and I'm just chipping at him. I said, Fritz, get this airplane on. Get this airplane on. Get this airplane on speed. If you don't get it, I'm going to give you a down. This is the worst. And I looked up in the cockpit, and there's this red light flashing. I go, huh. It says wheels. And I thought, I'll be damned. And so I write down, wheels light flashing, because I think it's just an inadvertent flash. And then I look up there, and there's a red light on in the gear handle. Red light on in the gear handle. And we get coming over what they call a fence, and all of a sudden things just kind of come together. And I go, holy bat guano. Oh, my God. And I took the airplane, slam power. We hit the runway, leapt into the air. Now, you know that the wheels aren't down because it's very noisy. And you don't have that kiss of the rubber, you know, when you hit the runway. It's blam, you know. So we leapt up into the air, and that kind of sobers you up, you know, and you go, holy crap. And Fritz said, what are we doing? I don't know what we're going to do. So we went up over, I told the tower, I said, we just made a low pass at your runway. And they said, well, we saw that. And I said, well, I contacted it. And they said, really? Do you want to scramble the emergency crew? And I said, no. And I'm going to check the airplane out. So we went up over the field, dropped the landing gear, checked the airplane. Now, it's just purring. And I can't figure out what happened. This plane had two long twin boom tail on the end of it. And I think maybe we just over-rotated and banged them. So I said, we'll go back to North Island. So we flew at North Island, and we get out of the airplane, and Fritz says, now what? And I said, well, you walk to the left, and I'll walk to the right, and we'll meet at the back, and there's no damage. I said, you go the other way. So we both go, I said, what the hell happened? You know, we can't see anything. And so we're walking away from the airplane, and the plane captain goes, Mr. Chappell, what's the matter with your props? And I turn around, and all eight blades are bent. And I'm just standing, my wings fell off my chest, you know, and I went, oh, well, there's your naval career, you're done. So that particular Friday, talk about God in your life, the squadron was having a picnic party. This flight was the last training flight for Fritz, so we were the only plane flying that day in the squadron. So everybody was out of the hangar except the maintenance chief, a tech rep for the engine company, and the CO, which was there for some paperwork. I saw his car there, so I go up and said, Skipper, I need to talk to you. And he said, what's going on? I said, good news, bad news. Good news, I'm here. Bad news, plane broken. He comes out and looks at it, and he's just standing there. He goes, he can't even talk. And he said, this is an accident. I can't save you. And this is going to be career-ending stuff. And I knew that. There's nothing I could say about that. And there was a chief petty officer who'd worked for me for a number of years and I guess really liked and respected me. He said, Skipper, you don't want to do this. We can take care of this. He said, what do you mean we can take care of this? He said, well, there's a plane in the hangar. It's called a hangar queen. It's so broken that we're just using it as a parts bin. And he said, it's got two good props on it. He said, well, take the props off, hang them on this airplane. And he said, well, yeah, but the props are going through the Navy system. He said, no, the tech rep will just put them on a truck and take them straight to the factory. And he goes, okay, well, how do we explain El Centro? And I said, I never declared an emergency. And so I walked right out of that thing. Now, see, you can't be an alcoholic because I do stuff like that. I don't get in trouble. I throw up an admiral in full dress uniform. And I didn't get into trouble. Because after it was all said and done, the skipper called me to his office and he said, "The admiral's going to write a letter of reprimand on you." This was in the Philippines. And when I'm in the Philippines, it's not pretty. And it was not pretty. I have a propensity. See, I know this young lady here, so don't tell anybody. I have a propensity sometimes to take my clothes off when I'm drinking. It's not impressive. And but it does upset the admiral's wife. And so he wanted to write a letter of reprimand on me, which he did. And the skipper calls me in his office and says, again, this is a new CO, and he says, "You're done." And I said, "But sir, you ordered me to drink last night," which he did. They had had this big chugging contest and lost over $1,000 and but I wasn't there. I was on the ship sick, and I'd come ashore just to eat something. They saw me in the dining room, pulled me in, and they said, "You got to get the money back." The CO said, and I said, "I can't." I said, I'm sick." He said, "I don't remember asking you. I want our money back." And I got their money back. And then after that, it was parties on. And then the admiral was really upset. And I was telling the skipper that. And I said, "Sir, if you hadn't ordered me to drink, I wouldn't have got drunk. And if I hadn't got drunk, I wouldn't have thrown up on the admiral." And he started laughing. And I knew I had him. And he said, "That's the damn funniest thing I've ever seen in my life." He said, "It was just a 3-foot projectile, you know. You hit him right in the white uniform and his ribbons and, you know." And he said, "I'll get you out of it." So I got out of it. In college, I stole 7 ID cards and wrote hot checks. Got captured, taken to the dean of students. They were going to kick me out. When the dean of students says, "Chapel," he said, "Your granddad isn't a guy by the name of Bill Chapel, isn't he?" I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Oh, my God, this will kill him. I can't kick you out of college." So I don't get arrested for stealing ID cards. I don't get in trouble for wheels up landings. I don't get in trouble. Now, I know I drink too much. I know that. And I guess I got to get honest, really. You know, I really am not an alcoholic. And the only reason I say that I am is because I like to do this. And they won't let you talk unless you say you're an alcoholic. But looking at some of you people and listening to your stories, you're alcoholic. Now, some of you look like alcoholics and you know who you are. And but not me. Because I don't have any DUIs, not been arrested, not been to jail, get out of all this trouble. I know I drink too much. But that's the problem. I just got to learn how to slow that down and drink. You know, I end up going to Vietnam a couple times. And over there once, I was walking down this dusty, dirty road. We were in what's called the Delta in Four Corps. And I was heading from the barracks down to the office. I was the operations officer. And I am so sick, and I puked a couple times on the way down there, and I'm just in a T-shirt, no hat, out of uniform. This chief comes up, and he said, "Sir, where you been?" "I don't know." And he says, "You're supposed to be down at the hangar getting an award." I said, "For what?" And he goes, "I don't know, but you're supposed to be down there." So he got me down there, and we're on a platform, and they come up from behind. The skipper's reading this piece of paper. Everybody's out there watching. The chief puts me up on the platform. And he turns around, he says, "You're out of uniform." "Yes, sir." "Where am I supposed to put the medal?" I said, "Just give it to me, because I'm going to throw up." And I turned to the right, and projectile puke, and 150 people went, "Yes, that's the way to do it," you know. And every port I went into, when I threw up on that admiral, people bought me drinks. "Are you the guy that threw up on the admiral?" "Yes." "Well, let me buy you drinks." "Are you the guy that puked at the ceremony in the morning?" "Well, let me buy you drinks." I mean, I'm a paid puker, and so they just love me. It was there that my first suicide attempt took place. I remember getting out of ward for a flight that I don't remember. I flew it in a blackout. I don't remember it. I got a piece of paper at home that says it was a pretty decent flight, enough to get a significant award for. I wish I'd been there, but I wasn't. I don't remember that flight. And I'm sitting in this room, and I got it padlocked on the inside, and I'm looking at that award, and I'm looking at myself in a mirror, and I can't figure out what the problem is. Because the insides and the outsides are just coming apart. I know how to look good. Even when I'm dying, I know how to look good. Because that's my saving grace. I've got to look good. And thank God for that. Now, in sobriety, like I said, it's not particularly cool. It's gotten me into some trouble because, but drinking, it was looking good. And I remember sitting there on the floor of this 8x8 room, and I'm sitting there with a 45, got it jacked in, chambered, off safe. And I'm sitting there putting it to my head saying, why don't you just pull the trigger? Because I couldn't understand what the feelings were. I was to find out several years later from a sponsor that the feelings I was feeling was separate, different, lonely, afraid, not part of, outside looking in, don't fit, don't belong. Never in my life did I do any of those things. From the first memory as a kid, being ostracized by my peers, you know, they play that baseball game where they... Oh, shit, we had him last week. I don't want him. You know, I couldn't play any things. So I'm looking good on the outside and dying on... And the more successful I get, the farther the insides get away. And I can't figure out... Because it's not alcohol. Because alcohol has taught me how to socialize and to be a part of. And I may bore you, but some of you have heard me do this before. And I stole this, so it's not mine. But within a couple months of drinking... The promises came true for me. Every one of them came true. Did your promises come true for you while you were drinking? Yeah, they did. I'm going to plagiarize this a little bit. If I was painstaking about this phase of my drinking, I was amazed before I was halfway through with the bottle. When I drank, I knew freedom and happiness. When I drank, I did not regret the past. When I drank, I seemed to find serenity and peace. When I drank, no matter how far down the scale I'd gone, I saw how my experience could benefit others. When I drank, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity disappeared. When I drank, self-seeking slipped away. When I drank, my whole attitude and outlook on life changed. When I drank, the big one, a fear of people and situations left me when I drank. And when I drank, I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle me when I was sober. That's why I drank. The promises came true. Or did they? Because if they'd really come true, you'd have a different speaker here. But in that sense, they were true. They provided everything that I could need. And yet I'm suicidal, and I can't figure out what's going on. And I go from there, and I go up to Lockheed, and I become a test pilot up there, and I start my individual bar drinking, and I'm... It's five bars from Burbank up to Valencia, where we were living. Two drinks at each bar, because even I know that if you sit at one bar and drink, you're going to look like that poor slob at the end of the bar has bounced his head out of the potato chips and slobbers running down his face. And you go, he's got a problem. But if you just have two social drinks and the bartender knows you, Steve, double scotch and soda, right, two. Two at every bar by the time you get home. That's 20 drinks. And then you get home and you sit downstairs and you drink till you pass out. And then you go upstairs at 3 in the morning, go to bed, and the day starts over. And you can't figure out what the problem is. By that time, I'm a competition skeet and trap shooter, shotguns. And now I'm putting loaded shotguns. I got a short barrel skeet gun that I'm resting my chin on, loaded off safe, trying to figure out what the hell to do. I even sit in the bathtub once because I didn't want to mess things up. I was going to be kind to my wife. I'm glad I chickened out. Anybody ever seen that speaker that blew the side of his face off? How many people have seen that guy? For those of you who have seen, I'll tell that little story. The first time, this is the only way I can tell a story. I'm not making fun of him. I can't remember. I'll just say Bob. My name is Bob. For you newcomers, if you're going to commit suicide, don't pull it out at the last moment because you blow your jaw off. You blow your ear off, you go blind in this eye, and you got a steel plate over here, and you slobber a lot, and welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. You go, holy crap. That could have been me. It's a powerful story. But I'd seen stuff like that. That didn't slow me down. My brother, my father, my mother were all alcoholics, and I'd bound and determined. I'm not going to be like, and I wasn't like them. My father was married 3 times. My brother lost a house in a poker game and put 6 children and his wife on the street. And he was in New York at the time. He's in the Advertising Hall of Fame. He's won 5 or 6 Clio Awards, which is like Oscars. He eventually ended up on Skid Row. He wrote all the Dutch Masters cigar ads with Ernie Kovacs. Some of you may remember those. That Ford Qualities Job 1, that was his, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he goes to Skid Row. I'm not on Skid Row. I'm only married one time. I'm rising up in my career. Don't you think it's a little strange you're putting guns in your mouth? Maybe for the moment, but a drink will take care of that later. But then it's not working anymore. It's not working. And, you know, up in the book tells us everything we need to know. It talks about, if I can find it here, these bedevilments, which are problems. I was having trouble with personal relationships. I couldn't control my emotional nature. I was prey to misery and depression. I couldn't make a living. I had a feeling of uselessness. I was full of fear, and I was always unhappy. And I couldn't figure out what the problem was. One day when I'm in Meridian, Mississippi, one of my last stations in the Navy, I end up getting a master's degree in counseling. And everything that I'm reading is going, well, that's really interesting. And then one day they come around and they ask for a volunteer commanding officer because they're testing a new program called the Navy Alcohol Safety Action Program. And they wanted one of the COs to go through and evaluate us. That'll be me because I look good in my service record. And then I became a facilitator. And this is my last 2 years of really bad drinking. And I'm teaching this course one day, and this third-class petty officer comes up and he said, sir, you've been drinking. I said, yes, I have. He said, but you're not supposed to drink. I said, excuse me. I'm the one teaching the course. This is about responsible drinking. That's what we teach here. I've been over at the O Club responsibly drinking. You were ordered here. You can't drink. And he got so close, I sent him to treatment, got him out of there. But because of my training, it would be two more years, and a couple more years of drinking. Then I ended up, because of this background, they sent me to run the Navy Alcohol Rehabilitation Center here in 30 seconds as the commanding officer. In July of 83, I showed up. I'd quit drinking 2 weeks earlier. Not because I'm an alcoholic, but because I thought it would be ethically incorrect to run a treatment program and drink. So I fully intended to drink 2.5 years later when the job was over, because I don't have any problem quitting drinking. So I check in, and Jerry Bunn is there, and he's the guy that was going to retire, and he called his staff together 15 minutes after I left, all the senior staff, and he said, oh, my God, we got a snot-slinging, gutter-crawling alcoholic on our name. And what are we going to do with him? Well, he's going to be running this place, but he's the most arrogant, egotistical man that I've ever met in my life, and he will die before he drinks at this treatment program. A year and a half later, I'm sitting at my desk in this incredible dry drunk, and for 3 days, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, I've had this radiating chest pain down my arm, down my jaw on my left side of my neck, and I finally wander upstairs to the doc, and I tell him that, and he just looks at me, and he says, go down and get in the car. And he calls Balboa Hospital and said, set up the treadmill, we're coming up. Well, they put me on the treadmill, and my heart is just the heart of an 18-year-old. There's nothing wrong with your heart. Do you drink? Nope. I haven't drank for a year and a half. Do you smoke? No, not for 4 or 5 years. You under any stress? Not that I'm aware of. It was just terrible stress. And eventually, because I was so obnoxious in that stress, you don't get fired from the Navy Alcohol Rehab Center. If you go there, it's because you want to go there. That's not a career-enhancing position. And I wanted to go there. I mean, I'd really gotten as high as I could in the military. And they said, a letter came from the admiral, says either quiet him down or get rid of him. And they got rid of me. And I spent 2 years over in Hawaii. Damn, the badass luck. But it was there that I really got sober in Hawaii. I started working the steps with my sponsor while I was... We go to 11 o'clock, is that it? Yeah. I was over in Hawaii, or just before I went to Hawaii, my sponsor said, I want you to work all the steps. And we did all 12 steps. And we did all 12 traditions. And we did all 12 concepts. And he said, you're going to get that base before you go over there. At 6 months sober, I walked into his office, and I called him up and said, I'm coming over. And he said, I'm busy. And I said, well, you be unbusy, because I'm going to be in your office in about 10 minutes. I showed up, and I was in my white short-sleeve uniform that day. He said, what's going on? I said, I just want to tell you I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. And he goes, what do you mean you're leaving Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, Jerry, I've done everything you've asked me to do. I've gone to 90 meetings in 90 days. I average 5 meetings a week. I've done the steps, the traditions, the concepts. I sponsor one poor bastard. I said, I'm service work in most meetings I'm in, and I've never felt so much pain in all my life, spiritual, emotional. And you promised me if I quit drinking, I'd feel better. He said, yeah, I said you'd feel better. You just forgot I said everything. When you quit drinking, you feel joy better, you feel sadness better, you feel anger better, you feel everything better. And I said, well, I didn't quit drinking to feel like this. And he said, I'm leaving. And he said, well, give me a couple minutes before you go. And I said, okay. He said, what's going on? He said, let me do a little review with you. Do you think you're an alcoholic? I was sitting there thinking. He goes, I can't even believe you. I said, all right. I'm an alcoholic. He said, intellectually, you agree to that? I said, yeah. He said, are you powerless over alcohol? I said, sometimes. He said, you lied to me then. I said, yeah, I did. Because you told me you were powerless. And I said, well, that's what you wanted to hear, and I'm in full compliance. I'm trying to look good, so I'm doing the steps. But I never believed I was powerless. Sometimes I was powerless. There were days when I actually went to a meeting and I wasn't drunk. I said, I cannot drink tonight because I got to get to that meeting. And I made it. No alcohol. There are other times when I couldn't do that, so sometimes I'm powerless. He said, I'll leave that one alone. Is your life unmanageable? I said, nope. He said, you lied to me? I said, yep. He said, why is your life not unmanageable? I said, Jerry, I'm at the height of my career. Only 3% of people make it to captain or whatever the number is. I got 2 cars, a big house. I'm on all these advisory boards. I travel all over. And my life's not unmanageable. And I just started sobbing, which was tacky when you're in uniform trying to look good. And he goes, well, Captain, if your life is working so well, why are you crying? And I didn't have an answer for that. I thought it was a trick question. I didn't have an answer for that. And then he stood me up, and he pointed all the junk on my uniform. And he said, huh. He said, let me ask you something. And that's when I first heard these words. At this moment, right now, in this uniform, telling me that you're not powerless and unmanageable, do you understand separate, lonely, different, afraid, not part of, outside looking in, don't fit, don't belong? And my knees literally buckled, and I just kind of fell into this chair. And he says, welcome to unmanageability. He said, for you, Steve, unmanageability is emotional unmanageability. You're banking it on the stuff. You got the stuff. How can you be an alcoholic if you have the stuff? But he said, your emotions are just a basket case, and they were wrecked. He said, that's why you're putting shotguns to your mouth and guns to your head. And I just lost it. And he said, now let me ask you one other question. He said, you intellectually understand you're an alcoholic, right? I said, yeah. He said, is it? And he had me standing up, and he just kind of tapped me lightly on the chest. And he said, in your heart of hearts, in your soul, in your gut, is it okay for you to be an alcoholic? And I just screamed. I said, no, it's not okay. Well, we read that. What's the first step? We have to admit to our innermost selves that we're an alcoholic. This is the first step. And if I'm not willing to make that admission, I am going through the motions of the steps. And a lot of guys I've sponsored over the years have gotten themselves, they're not okay with it. Oh, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I don't want to be one. Everybody in my family, and I screamed at him and standing, and I said, Jerry, you see a self-made man. At 17, I got myself out of that sick house I was in. I put myself in college. I put myself through school on loans. I got into the Navy. I'm the one that got this career going. What you see here is all self-made. And there's some truth to that. But I'm dying behind that. And my family is just screwed, and I don't want to be like them. He said, well, Steve, if you leave, you will become just like them. If you stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can break that chain. You can be the sober member that nobody in your family ever was, and you can finally be a part of. And I did. I stayed that day for 4 hours, he says, or longer. We just sat there. I don't remember what we talked about, but when I left that day, it was okay in my heart to be an alcoholic. Today, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm glad, and some people say, I'm grateful to be in recovery, but not grateful to be an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be an alcoholic, because if I weren't an alcoholic, I wouldn't have found the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd put a shotgun to my mouth and finally done it. Without that disease, I couldn't have come here and found you. I couldn't have found the steps. I couldn't have found the program. I couldn't have found God, as I understand Him for me, which is God. I couldn't understand that. I mean, a lot of us know people that are not in this program, and there are people in this program who have some pretty serious health diseases. Everything from cancer to emphysema to whatever. And to watch those people go through that stuff surrounded by the love of this program, and many of us know people who have not in some sort of a program like this, it's not a pretty sight sometimes. And so I'm so grateful that the cure for this disease is to find people who drink like me, who can walk with me, who can help me out, who can hold me, hug me, laugh with me, cry with me, walk me through the steps and find a power grade in myself. You don't have to stick any needles in my body. You don't have to put me in chemotherapy. You don't have to operate on me. You don't have to do anything. Walk up to the cancer ward and say, hey, I can give you 12 steps. You can walk right out of here. They jump at it. And we go, take the steps? You got to be kidding me. I'm in the step a month club, the step a year club. Oh, my God, if we just spent 10% of the effort we did when we were drinking, our programs would be marvelous. Where do you want to meet me, Charlie? Let's go to that meeting about 4 miles from... What? You want me to drive 4 miles to go to an AA meeting? You got to be kidding me. I'd go any distance. If tonight we were still an active group of drinkers and partiers, and I said, look, right now it is 8 minutes till nine. I got a buddy up in Los Angeles. If this group has 3 hours as a group to get together and somehow get to L.A., we will literally get a semi-truck full of scotch, bourbon, and about 30 pounds of cocaine. We'd be there. I mean, anything it took to get there. We will go any lengths to kill ourselves. We will go any distance to buy the booze and the drugs, but I won't walk across the street to go to a meeting because it's too damn far to go across the street. North Park men's, La Mesa men's, two-hour meetings. Newcomers walking, 2 hours? Oh, my God. I used to sit there in a bar and say, oh, God, I'm going to have to sit on this bar stool for 2 hours and get drunk. Oh, I can't stand it. Hell, I sat there for 8 hours, 10 hours. You know how drunk you are when you're sitting on a bar stool? How many people tried to get up off the bar stool but you didn't get your feet unhooked? And as you go down, you're hanging on the bar, right? I want to see your hand. Come on. Yeah. And you look like a real buffoon, don't you, going down? Just awesome stuff.
We were cool.
And the drunks didn't go. They just kind of went, oh, you know, and forgot about it. It's amazing stuff. How many people picked up a cigarette and lit in first? Oh, yeah, there's a good one. And you said, I was going to do that anyway. I was just showing you I could eat lighted cigarettes. You know, that's not a problem. You know, at 5 years sober, my wife asked me to go by a screen door and a particular security door. And I didn't want to go to this store. It's a very small store. Nobody knew that one of my biggest secrets, and I was 5 years sober. I'd be 50 years old at that time. And I had never taken anything back to a store in my life. I was terrified to take stuff back to stores. I could not do it. If I walked into your small store all by myself and you said hello to me, T, I'd buy something. I'd come home with stuff, and my wife would say, what'd you buy that for? Sweetheart, because I couldn't tell them that I didn't want anything because they might not like me and say, the kid out of my store, you just can't look around unless you're going to buy something. I bought a power saw from Sears. We buy Sears tools because you can run over them with a tractor and they'll give you a free one back. I took it out of the box. It didn't work. I tried every plug in the garage. Went into the house. Now, I already knew it didn't work, but and I threw it away because I could not take it back. A couple weeks later, bought a brand new one. So she goes down, I get that screen door, and I said, I don't want to do it. She said, I want that screen door. And besides, they were on sale 6 months ago. I said, that's 6 months ago. And she said, I want that door. So I go down there and walk in, and I find the door, and I'm standing in line. The guy says, I'll write this up for you. And I looked up at him, almost verbatim, and said, you know, that screen door was on sale 6 months ago for half price. I don't suppose you get it to me for half price today, would you? He goes, yeah. And then I walked away. He goes, where are you going? I forgot some nails. And I went over in this corner, and I was sobbing because it was the first time in my life I had done anything like that. It was just incredible. You know, 10, 12 years sober, I had a new sponsor. My other sponsor had moved out of the area, and I'm working on issues of incest in Vietnam, and it was just really gnarly, and I really had gone into some depth in writing. And I was asked to speak at a convention in St. Louis, and so I was flying back, stopped off in Kansas City to see my sister, and she was in a nursing home. She said, before you go, I got to tell you something. My counselor says I'm supposed to tell you. And then she said, told me that while my dad was dry, he went to Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. For 25 years, never darkened their door. And in dryness, lost every friend that he ever had, every family member. And for 3 years, from about 10 to 11 to 12, incested my sister on a regular basis. And I know the difference between dry drunk and recovery. You know, and I was incested. And so I hit this conference. I couldn't even speak. I got a hold of the conference chair, and I said, I can't talk. I just can't. I'm so screwed up here. And I told him what was going on. And I said, if I could refund this ticket somehow, I'd be back on an airplane, and I'm sorry about that. And he said, no, you're going to stay here. You're going to be surrounded by the love of this program. We'll get a different speaker. I said, fine. He said, but at least sit on the dais as we brought you back here. I said, okay. So about 5 minutes before the speaker who I'd been introduced to, and he said, you know that guy down there on the end, that's my grand sponsor. And then my sponsor, and I said, yeah, I met them both, nice guys. He said, we just took a vote. You're speaking. And I said, the hell I am. And they said, the hell you're not. You're speaking. Steve, you're here for a reason. And, and to this day, I have no idea what the talk was. I met a guy maybe 5 years ago who was out here in La Jolla. And he said, I heard you speak in St. Louis. But the CD, the machine broke that day. Now, the next morning, this guy comes up to me at breakfast, and he walks up and he says, I'd like to thank you for your talk last night. I said, you're welcome. He said, would you stand up and let me give you a hug, please? I said, absolutely. And verbatim, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I'm 75 years old. I'm 30 years sober. You're the first man I've ever told I was incested. Thank you for your share. The book says we will not regret the past. We will not wish to shut the door on it. Our character defects will become our greatest assets. Once I found freedom to start talking about that, and I talk about it at meetings, all over the country people come and said, can I talk to you after this meeting? Particularly men. I don't mean this any other way. It's a fallacy we expect women to be incested. But the amount of men that have been incested by fathers or brothers or mothers is larger than anybody ever knows. And they're afraid to talk about it. They don't know what to do with that. You know, the book says, I think it's about page 132 or somewhere in there, there are many fine doctors and psychologists and practitioners of other kinds. Do not hesitate to make good use of them. I had to get some outside help on those issues. The book authorizes that. The book authorizes me, by the way, to read non-AA literature. When it's talking about go to your chaplain or whoever and get that literature that you need to pray with or meditate with, that's not AA literature when they tell you to go to your priest or whatever. I'll use whatever is necessary to keep me sober. This is the foundation of my program. And then I enhance it with whatever I need to enhance it with and staying sober. You know, I love it when they put this up here. I've heard this before. What's the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous? It's a life centered on helping others live in complete sobriety, and we do that anonymously. And so we just go about doing that anonymously and helping people to stay sober. The book says several places, when all else fails, go find another alcoholic to speak with and get out of yourself. I love being sober. I love sponsoring. I love my sponsor. I love the program. I'm in lots of service work. I mean, there's people in here, we've been on service committees and working together and just incredible stuff. I love it. And I couldn't have found it. I'll end up with this. My wife and I were talking one day years ago, and I was talking to my sponsor, and I said, Barbara, this is Jerry, and he's responsible, and AA's responsible for getting me sober. And she says, I'm sorry, that's not true. I said, it's not. She says, I prayed for 17 years. That's why you're here. And she said, he was a little slower than I wanted, but the reason you're here is because I was praying. You know, and I'll end up with this. I can find it in here. It's, where did I do with it? There it is. I just went by it. I can find it one more time. There it is. Something that I picked up years ago at a conference. I asked God to take away my pain. God said, no, it's not for me to take away, but for you to give up. I asked God to grant me patience, and God said, no. Patience is a byproduct of tribulations. It isn't granted. It's earned. I asked God to give me happiness. God said, no, I give you blessings. Happiness is up to you. I asked God to spare me pain. God said, no. Suffering draws you apart from worldly cares and brings you closer to me. I asked God to make my spirit grow, and God said, no, you must grow on your own, but I will prune you to make you fruitful. I asked God for all things that I might enjoy life, and God said, no, I will give you life so that you may enjoy all things. And finally, I ask God to help me love others as much as He loves me. And God says, finally you have the idea. Thanks.